Pray especially as we consider doing that in the plans for when we are no longer managers of what you have given to us, but pass that responsibility on to others, that you will help us to do that in a way which encourages others and strengthens them. Bless our time together, we ask this morning, for it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, I probably should give you just a backdrop of how I became involved in doing estate planning work and teaching and stewardship. I've worked for the denomination now, believe it or not, for over 20 years. I still find that hard to believe myself when I hit that milestone a year or so ago. But I came working for the church pretty much in a financial capacity right from day one. My first title was controller. I was to actually consolidate all the financial operations of the denomination, which had been splintered into different committees, and consolidate all that work and streamline it, computerize it. It had not been computerized yet, at least completely. And so that was really the focus of my work to begin with. And shortly after I got that all underway, back in the late 80s, early 90s, they asked me to take on the responsibility of the loan fund, which had been kind of a small back operation of the Home Missions Committee for years. They had serviced some loans and helped churches with buildings. And really how that happened was there were a couple churches who wanted to go into a building program but didn't have the resources. A couple other people heard about that and said, well, we'd like to help that church, but we don't want them to know who it is that's helping them, so can we give you the money and then you loan it to them, and then when they pay it back, you can give it back to us. It was really that kind of an informal arrangement the Home Missions Committee started back in the 70s getting involved with, and it developed into what's now the OPC Loan Fund. And the OPC Loan Fund actually now has assets that have exceeded $10 million, and we service 40 loans to 40 different OPC churches right now. So as far as churches that have buildings in the OPC, we have financed almost the complete majority of them. There's just a few that we have not been involved in the financing. So just in terms of that ministry to the denomination, it's interesting. I looked back a couple of years ago and I counted, 330-plus OPC churches nationally. And then I looked through the directory and looked how many were renting facilities versus how many owned. Roughly half of our churches own buildings, the other half are in rented facilities. So there's a lot of work for the loan fund in years to come. You might say job security. In that standpoint, we've got to move a lot of people into buildings. In one sense, we're about ready to celebrate a year from now our 75th anniversary as a denomination. And as I look back at that and thought, well, 75 years, why aren't we further along in terms of building acquisitions? A couple of reasons, I think. Number one is the real estate market in the last 20 years has jumped dramatically. Now we've seen a little bit of a pullback, but the real estate market has been that way. But as you look over the 75 years of our denomination, you need to do a little history check. And if you know the history of the OPC when they started and came out of the United Presbyterian Church, many had to walk away from their buildings in order to begin a church. So although we had a number of churches initially started, by walking away, they also walked away from real estate and started without a building. And without getting too sidetracked off of that, as I studied that issue, I thought, well, why are we're still at today? One of the reasons that happened, a result of that walking away from a building, was no local congregation ever wanted to have denominational ownership of buildings again. We want our own building because we don't want that issue to happen. And so you might say the pendulum, in my estimation, swung way over here. We said, keep the denomination away as far as helping with buildings. One of the things we're starting to find now is many mission works that start struggle for a long time because they don't have a building. And many of them would love to have the denomination come in and say, we'll provide a building for you. We'll start it for you, and then we'll let you buy it out from us, when you're able to. But that initial thrust of being able to get a building, many churches aren't able to do. So anyway, we've been involved in trying to help bring that pendulum back somewhere in the middle, saying, let the denomination help you get involved into a building program, whether it's an addition or whether it's your first building. We don't really care about ownership. That's not our point. It's to assist the congregation in gaining a valuable tool in their ministry. So as this church gets to that point of needing help with a building, the loan fund is there to help churches, and we generally always have funds available. If we need more, we can push in terms of looking for new investments in the fund. But we stand ready to help the church here as well. So that was back in the 90s I got involved in doing the loan fund work. And then in the late 90s, after we kind of got the loan fund up and running and to a good level, the Committee on Coordination, who hires me, said, You know, we've been looking at our mandate, and one of our mandates by our General Assembly is to encourage stewardship education in the church. And we don't think we're doing much in terms of stewardship education. Is there a way you can help us with that? And as I looked further, one of the areas that I realized some of the original founders had done a lot of work in the denomination was encouraging stewardship education as it came to planning your estate. And so I went and got training for estate planning back in the late 90s. And so for about a little over 10 years now, I've been encouraging churches in stewardship, and especially as it relates to planned giving. Estate planning is a very broad topic. I've always told people if you look this weekend to go to an estate planning seminar this weekend, if you're in most major metropolitan areas, you probably could have found three or four ads in the classifieds of estate planning seminars going on. And as you looked at that estate planning seminar going on, it was probably sponsored either by an attorney, a financial planner, a life insurance representative, but somebody who was planning that had an interest in it, because hopefully if you did your estate plan, you'd eventually need legal services, or you would need planning services of some sort. And so the incentive for them to give you a free estate planning seminar was some business that might result out of it. Now, I've often had people wonder, so why are you doing an estate planning seminar? What's the church have in this? You know, what do you have in it? Let me give you a disclaimer right up front. Community and Coordination has asked me to do this to encourage you to be a good steward of what God's entrusted to you. That's the point of this seminar today. If you walk away from anything, I hope you're a better steward of what God's entrusted to you. And understand that estate planning is not a mechanical process. It's a spiritual process. And so frequently we get into this mindset of, you know, that's something I haven't done. I just need to complete and check it off my list. I'm going to go to an attorney, sit down and get this done. And we never once pray about it. Consult with others about it, talk to our children about it. It's just some mechanical process that we've completed and can check off that list and say, okay, I have it finished. And what I hope you'll uncover today through this time together is that it's more than that, much more than that. And as a good steward, you need to give careful consideration. I believe it's your last act of stewardship when you have the opportunity to review it in a spiritual construct. Now, I'm going to go through a lot of information today, and obviously we're not going to become tax experts in the next couple of hours. My goal is to give you some overview information. You might say the 30,000 or 30,000 feet view down and kind of a lay of the land and understand estate planning a little bit. I want to challenge you in some areas as a Christian, how we look at estate planning and how that affects our decisions that we make. And then give you a few tools to put in your toolbox as you consider how to put your estate plan together. Any questions when I start up front here, just in terms of what you hope I cover or we're looking to see covered? All right, let me just dive in. I put up on the overhead here, it's basically a four-step process, the estate design process. It's number one, setting priorities, and we're going to become jumping into that very quickly, especially as Christians, how we set those priorities. And then we'll become familiar with the legal terms and basic tax rules and tools that are available. And I'll give you a little bit of an update there. We're going to spend a bit of time there, not so that you become experts, but you understand what that process looks like and what tools are available. One of the things that in my 10 years I've been doing this that I've come across is most people have this certain view in their mind as to how the estate plan works. It's some basic observations that you've seen, and you know, if I have three kids, I divide my estate three ways, and I got to be careful, or I'll have some estate taxes, so I got to just make sure I don't do a couple pitfalls. And if I stay away from those, I'm complete. And what I wanted to cover today is just hopefully expanding your world when it comes to estate planning, and saying there's a lot more that you could do other than what is the routine. So we'll challenge that, and then I'll give you a step three and four. Are really kind of going to be sending you on the right track. We're not going to cover much in step three or four. I'll show you how to gather the necessary data and encourage you to seek competent counsel, but that's not something that we're going to be spending much time with. So one and two are primarily the steps that we'll be involved with today. However, having said that, I won't be getting much into step three and four. The problem frequently I found as follow-up to these seminars is I do step one and two and walk you through that, and you go, ooh, there's some things I really need to do here. you know, there's some things I need to address here. So step 3 and 4 are still on your to-do list, and I'm finding that they never get done. You know, my dad used to say it was always the tyranny of the urgent. You know, what are the urgent things? And we sometimes don't think these things are very urgent. You know, these things, I'll have time later to deal with these things. I'll get around to this. And I often encourage people, you know, if you don't follow up with step 3 and 4 within a week or two after we're done, you probably won't do it in the next year or two. If it doesn't happen, if this doesn't trigger it in motion, it's unlikely that 3 months from now you're going to go, oh, now I need to pick that up and do it. It'll just get shoved aside. It'll collect dust on the counter for a while, then it goes to that. I don't know if you have it in your house, but there's progressions of where stuff goes in the house. You know, there's the counter, the kitchen counter, where it's kind of the immediate stuff that has to be dealt with. And then it gets moved. There's a table that's off to the side of that. And if it's my stuff, my wife eventually puts it on a stack that goes out to my office. I mean, there's a progression where things move. And then there's a point where it either has to hit the recycling can or it has to go into the bookshelf or whatever it is. This will start that process if you don't deal with it immediately. So I would encourage you to follow up with 3 and 4 very quickly. This Christian concept of estate planning, I want to spend a little time on this. And I was mentioning to Carlos and to Edie last night, I just recently picked up a book by Ron Blue called Splitting Heirs. Now, Ron Blue, I don't know how many of you are familiar with, he effectively picked up where Larry Burkett left off, is how I tend to put him in that camp. Ron Blue was around when Larry was around, but Ron wasn't as well known at that point in time. And then he teamed up with Larry, wrote a couple books with Larry Burkett, and kind of took over when Larry passed away. So he comes from that mindset. And if you know what Larry Burkett's mindset was, he was very, debt was a very negative word in his view, and no matter what debt it was, whether it was on your home or whatever else. I don't know where you line up with that. Personally, I always was a little bit, I was not quite as far over as Larry was. I certainly appreciated a lot of what he put out. I mean, I think he put a lot of information that just hadn't been put out yet in people's hands in terms of financial management. But Ron Blue has written a book that this is hitting right where I'm going to spend a little time this morning on how we as Christians develop an estate plan. What are the principles that apply, and how do we go about doing that? Because, again, culturally, we are in a place where over the last, especially 50 to 100 years, the mindset has been for most, well, let me ask you, what do you think the mindset is of most Americans, how they put their estate plan together? If you would guess what the average estate plan looks like, what does it look like in terms of where do the assets go when they die? Okay. Okay, so there's an interest in keeping taxes low, but primarily, if a husband or wife dies, it goes to the spouse, right? And when the spouse passes away, it generally goes to the kids, usually an equal distribution of some sort. I mean, that's just the mindset. So if you walk into an attorney's office and said, I'd like to do an estate plan, that's going to be his assumption, basically, coming into his office. That's how you're going to divide up the estate. Why do you think that's developed that way? Why do you think those assumptions are there? Think back. Let me take a step back with you. Go back 50, 75 years ago. Go back even further. Go back 100 years ago, because that's really, I think, it goes 100 years back. It's exaggerated more 100 years ago. In this country, we began as a very agricultural country. A lot of agriculture was produced here, and that was the way a lot of people made a living. And in this area, there's probably very few farmers in your congregation here anymore. Maybe some with the cranberries or whatever else, but very few who actually harvest some type of crop here. We live in South Jersey. There are still some who farm, but most of them are what I call gentleman farmers. They're really not into it seriously. You almost have to go out to the Midwest before you'll find any kind of sizable farms where people are actually deriving an income that's supporting their family. But with that backdrop, with it being an agricultural economy, the way in which you passed on the wealth to your children was you effectively passed on the family farm. That's how it became known as the family farm, because if you gave the kids the farm, especially the boys could work the farm, produce an income. So the inheritance that you left the kids was the farm. And if the daughters married somebody else, maybe they inherited the family farm, and that's how people were able to survive. What do you believe has replaced the family farm? The home, but not really. That produces
money in the bank or stocks.
Yeah, but here's where I'm driving at. I think that can provide a resource for the kids. But what did the family farm do? They didn't get any money out of the farm. They got an asset that they could work that could produce an income, right? What asset can you give to your kids that'll help them produce an income? Yes, the asset of an investment account can produce interest. But even now, we know that fluctuates. But what asset can you give to your children that will help them?
Education.
See, I believe significantly the education has replaced the family farm. So the inheritance you can give to your children in terms of the skills they need to go into the marketplace has to do with their education. Whether that's a trade school, just a high school degree, advanced degree of some sort, the importance is that you give them the education, so that's the tools in their tool bag. That's the family farm that they need to be able to go out and generate income. So I think we've made a transition in terms of what we're passing on to our kids in terms of that, quote, inheritance, and yet there's still this assumption that the thing we give is the family farm. Well, you know, which might just be the family house at this point in time and the value of it or whatever else, but we've made that transition in terms of providing that resource, and yet there's still this expectation that the family farm is on its way to the kids as well. Now, in just a second here, I'm going to get into, so what do we do about that? And I'm not here to just advocate, well, that we don't give anything but an education to the kids, that we don't give money, but I'm just saying, I think that we have to understand the mindset that's behind this and the assumptions that are taking place in our culture today, is because that's where we were. That's where this country was. The way you gave something to the kids is they could never afford to go out and buy the farm. So if you gave them the farm, they could at least work it and produce the income. Now, let me address that a little bit more specifically in terms of some of the what I call Christian concept of estate planning, definition of lifestyle. All of us have resources at our disposal: time, talent, and treasure. Correct? I mean, we all have that those assets to a differing degree. Time, we all have the same amount of time, but God has gifted us some with one talent, some with another, and treasure. Some have more than others in terms of what they can pass on to others. But we developed a lifestyle, how we utilize those resources. And that lifestyle has given us the opportunity to make certain decisions regarding how we spend our time, how we spend our money and our resources. And that's reflected in what we do every day, what's a priority to us. And hopefully those priorities are somewhat have already passed on to our children as we've raised our children. They've seen those priorities that we have, and some of them embrace those priorities that we have, and some of them may have slightly different priorities than we have, and not one being right and one being wrong, but maybe just a different focus and different direction. We need to reflect that when we consider our estate plan. What is it that we are prioritizing, and what has led us to value those things, some things more than others? I've already briefly talked about the inheritance to our children's children. Probably one of the greatest things we can leave our children has nothing to do with these worldly goods, but it's our faith in terms of God's covenant promises, seeing it come to fruition in our children, accepting Christ as their Lord and Savior, and seeing them mature in their faith. I mean, that's probably one of the greatest things you could ever even consider giving to your children is that Christian training and background and encouragement in their faith. But as we look at the Christian estate plan, one of the things you have to start thinking through is there are different plans that are going to be in place for you at different times. Most of you are getting to past middle age and moving past that point, and now are at a point where you're starting to consider your estate in a different way, for example, than James and Chantry might be thinking about their estate plan with young kids. There is a point in time where things start to change in terms of your plans and your circumstances. When you have younger kids, and I still have a few, not as young as James's, but my youngest is 12, but you're thinking of providing for your family in your estate plan in terms of the basic necessities, and are you adequately preparing for your family in terms of an estate plan so that your children can be cared for or your spouse can be cared for. But once you've kind of had the kids grown up and raised and you're reaching your sunset years, you might call them, those are the years in which you start to really consider where are my children in terms of their needs and how can I best plan my estate? And that becomes a more difficult question to work through. Now, I want to just kind of revisit a couple things I just mentioned earlier in terms of grown children and estate plans, because again, one of the first things, let me just jump a couple ahead a little bit here. Let me I don't have it on the slide here, but let me address just a couple issues that are again addressed. I'm only halfway through this book. I read a little bit more last night. I really encourage you. This will give you one of the biggest decisions you're going to have to reach first. And again, let me explain maybe what I handed out to you. You have one of these folders here. Inside of it was a text of what we're going through today. So you have a text included in here. This folder, if you aren't familiar with it, is a folder that I developed over the years, but it was kind of conceived as an idea out of something that happened when my dad passed away. My dad had cancer and was diagnosed with it really 9 years before he died. And one of the things he told me when he was diagnosed with cancer early on was, he said, "David, you know, when things progress and God calls me home, I want you to know there's a file upstairs in my file cabinet and it has all the information you need, you know, when I pass away." And I kind of just filed that away, but no, come on, Dad, you're going to live longer than that. But I was aware of that. And God's kindness, my dad lived 9 more years, and when he died, he died with all of his family around him at home. It was a wonderful time of singing and praying with him as God came and took him. It was a wonderful time. And yet at that time, you know, the thought hit me that evening. "That's right, Dad said that file's upstairs. I need to go find that." So after God called him home, within hours, I walked upstairs and sat in his office, and I rolled open the file drawer and I pulled out a file. I went thumbing through it and found the file. And it was a wonderful file to pull open, because he had everything in there. And he had, very personal notes in there. "David, you're going to need to call the following people because they likely will not hear that I passed away, and I really would appreciate it if you personally call the following people." And he had a list of people for me to call. He had the number of the undertaker, you know, as to who to call, because, in case he died at home, which he did. So we had the phone number there. Now, we had already figured that out, but he had it there. He had a wonderful layout of his memorial service as to what he wanted done at the memorial service. And, even very personal notes. You know, "I definitely want the gospel preached at my memorial service. And I'd prefer the pastor to do that." He said, "But don't let him preach too long." You know, I mean, it was that specific. He said, "I don't want to, you know, have it be..." And he says, it was just very, very, very helpful. The hymns that were important to him and special to him that he would like sung at that memorial service. He also had in there, you know, "Here's where you can find the following items. You know, my last will is in the safe deposit box. My financial records can be found in this drawer and also in the safe deposit box." He gave everything. "Here's all my pertinent information, my social security number, date of birth, all this you're going to need for the death certificate. Make sure you have..." It was in one file. Now, it wasn't organized quite this way, but we knew for 9 years that my dad was going to die of this disease. I mean, Lord could have called him home sooner, but we knew that that was the progression. And one of the things that struck me, having dealt with a few others who have gone through some pretty traumatic end-of-life issues, is when people are in that situation, they're usually not the most level-headed. You know, there are emotions at play that are usually not at play, that when you've lost a loved one, you're suddenly forced to deal with. And to have something this organized and this filled out keeps you from having to make those difficult decisions when you really don't want to make those decisions. They've already been made. James, you've already done that, but maybe some of you have done that with friends or even some of your family, where you're being forced to make decisions about caskets and burial plots and, you know, all these things, and you don't care. I mean, that's not... You're grieving. You're you don't even want to think about those things, and yet you're being forced. If memorial service, it's just like one of those other details that I got to work through, and I know I got to do this, and I know it, but your mind's a million different places, and you're just trying to keep your thoughts. To be able to pull open a file like this and say, well, this person already thought about that, and here, James, here's the service they'd like to have done. Can you conduct the service? I mean, what a blessing to not have to sit there and work through that. Trying to scratch through records and go, I know Dad had a will. I wonder where he left it. You know, it's not in this file. We checked the safe deposit box. I know he told me he had one. I wonder where it is. You know, but to be able to just pull, oh, he said he left it in his bottom right drawer of his desk. You know, oh, there, that's where it's at. Or, you know, Dad said something all the time about getting some money from this annuity, but I can't find any records of that annuity. I wonder, did it run out? Did it, you know, what happened with it? But to be able to pull out one file, oh, that annuity, oh, that record is found in the binder on the bottom shelf of his bookcase or whatever else. I mean, what a wonderful help. So that's what this is designed for, is to give you that roadmap. You don't stick everything in here. This isn't so that you can put all the stocks and everything else into this folder. It's simply been designed to tell you where you can find the important documents. So hopefully it'll be of some use to you or others. And if you want others for children or grandchildren or friends that you think could benefit from it, you can do that as well. But tucked inside is a little document called a Will and Trust Planning Guide, a guide to planning your will and trust. And this is where you'll eventually collect all the information you're going to need to put your estate plan together. It's pretty simple and pretty straightforward. I'm going to go through some of this information later in our seminar, but it's a way for you to really gather the specific data that's going to have to be put into an estate plan. But one of the things you'll notice early on in this, and I think it's on page 4 and 5. 4 is pretty easy. You'll fill out page 4. That's just a standard form. You need your name, marital status, information on previous marriages and your spouse's name and everything else. Then you'll get to the children. Filling that out's not going to be too difficult on 5 and 6. But at some point, what you're going to need to do is take this and say, okay, here's everything I own. Here's all the insurance policies I have. Here's all my liabilities. Here's who I'd like to be the executor of my estate. These are all the data collection points. But the next question is going to be, what do I want to do? What, you know, God's entrusted me to care for these things, and I'm going to pass them on to others to care for them. How do I make that decision as to where they are going to be managed next? Who I'm going to give these things to? Do I just divide it 3 ways because I have 3 kids, or 4 ways because I have 4 kids? Do I tithe 10% of it to the church? How do I make these determinations as to what to do with what God's entrusted me with? And I'm finding more and more that that's a difficult point for people. In other words, there are things that keep people from doing wills. Number one issue that keeps people from doing wills is guardianship of children. They can't decide who I should select as a guardian for my children. And I know I have to answer that question to complete my will. And since I can't figure out how to answer it, I'm not going to get my will done. I mean, that's de facto what happens. I don't think it's a conscious decision, but I've watched people who we've actually sat down in some of my seminars and said, let's fill these out right now. And they get to that page, and I watched husband and wife whisper back and forth a couple times, and then we flip the page, and they haven't filled it out yet. You know, and what I encourage you to do when we fill this out, and we'll talk about guardianship a little bit later, is you need to put a name on that, you know, when you fill that out. You can come back and revisit it. You can say, I'm not sure it's the best, we've never talked to them about it, but just put a name down. But the important issue is going to be, how do I decide who gets what? How do I determine how to pass this on? Ron Blue addresses this significantly. And if that's where you get stuck, I would encourage you to read that book, because what it's going to challenge you with is, what are the things that are going to impact that decision? He talks about, in his book, loving all your children equally, but treating them uniquely. And how do you do that? It's going to be based on where your children are at. If my mom is in her 80s now, and which means I'm 47, my sister's 48, and I got 2 brothers, so they're in their early 40s. We're all in our 40s. Well, well into our life patterns and everything else. We're not in those initial stages of just graduating from college and whatever else. We're not still in high school. We're at that point. When you think of your children inheriting and passing things on to them, one of the things you want to consider is where are they at in terms of their life issues, financial issues, and how can I best help them? And what Ron's saying is, how much can you give your children without hurting them? How much can you give them without hurting them? You know, and you need to consider each child when you do that, and some may be able to manage money really well. And you think would be, I could probably leave my whole estate to them and it wouldn't be a problem. Others you might go, well, they've always struggled with finances, you know, and if I do that, I'm not sure how it's going to impact them. Also, you have to wrestle with the issue of, well, I never thought about the inheritance leaving my children being the education that they have. They have great paying jobs. They're doing very successful, well, and successful in their life's vocation. They are able to adequately and beyond, you know, for their family, care for their family. I don't think they really would need much of an inheritance money-wise in terms of caring for their children, or I think they're pretty well set. So maybe you want to consider, well, how else could I use what God's entrusted to me? You know, are there opportunities to give charitably in my estate that I've never been able to do during my lifetime because things were always tight? I always had to just, you know, I tithed, but I wasn't able to do more than that. I was able to be blessed because of that, but I've always wanted to do more. Maybe your estate plan allows you that opportunity to do more. As Ron says also in his book, one of the things that you really want, and I've had sat down with people, and they've said to me, all right, we're kind of stuck on this issue of what to do with the estate. We've heard what you said, but we're really not sure what to do. And what they're looking for, always, I found out, is they want me to tell them how they should lay out their estate. And I keep saying, that would be David Haney's plan of stewardship for your estate. That's not what God's plan is. What you need to wrestle with and pray about is what does God want you to do with what he's entrusted to you? What are the principles that have governed how you functioned in caring for his things before, and how do you see those best carried out in the future? I've seen many who've said, well, I'd like it to carry out the same way I've carried things out. And so they try to put all these provisions into their estate plan, so whoever inherits whatever they have must manage it in the same way they managed it. As I say, that's trying to control it from the grave. I don't think you can do that. I mean, you can try. You can try to put parameters around it and provisions around it. I've seen estate plans where the denomination has been a beneficiary of the estate plan, and the gift comes and we get a copy of the will, and it's got like these provisos in it. And it's like, as long as it's given to a church that doesn't teach theonomy or doesn't do this or doesn't do that, and it's like, you know, how do you adequately address those concerns? But again, people trying to control it. And that's where I say, you know, you need to trust the Lord. You make the best decision you think you can make in terms of the guiding principles that you have, but you have to let that go. I mean, that's something where you need to trust the Lord with it and go from there. But your estate plan, as you make those decisions, you know, I can't make them for you. Those are things you need to wrestle through and say, okay, based on our conversation together, maybe we sit down with our pastor or an elder and say, here's what we're wrestling with. Can you give us any advice on this? And I'm glad to give you advice too, but one of the things I always turn that back to are, what are you supporting now? What are you doing with what God's given you now? Those are the things that are important to you right now. You're helping your children. You're helping your church. You're helping this educational institution. You're helping this. What are the things that God has put on your heart right now where you're giving of your time or your resources now? And typically, I think that's the case that you want to reflect that somehow in your estate plan. Now, I don't want to get too sidetracked with that because there are other technical aspects of the estate plan that I want to get to, but to me that's largely the crux of this estate plan. We'll get to the tools that you need and the tools that are helpful in the toolbox and how you can accomplish more than you thought you could in your estate plan. But without that understanding of first of all, it being the Lord's that you're managing, you're just a steward, and I probably can't emphasize that enough. We tend to, in fact, let me just use that as a launching pad to jump into that, to the next issue. What I call here five ways for a steward to take title to property. And I say that in that direction. I'm not sure it's I call it, on your outline on page 5, 5 basic types of property ownership. And what I'm trying to reflect here is, yeah, it's ownership, but really ultimately it all belongs to the Lord. We're just stewards of what belongs to the Lord. And I think we sometimes miss that because, I mean, I can pull out of my drawer the title to my car and it's got my name on it. It doesn't say God's, right? I mean, it says David's, you know, but, and we tend to get into that mindset, it's mine, right? I mean, our kids do that from day one, right? They're playing in the nursery and that's mine, you know, and they have a sense of possessions of belonging to us kind of infiltrates our thinking in many ways. And so we don't often think of it as the Lord's and we think of it more in terms of ours. But we need to recognize that ultimately it belongs to the Lord. But let me just go through this. The ways in which we can take title or own property, there are 5 basic ways we can do it. The individual ownership, this is property that you own in your name only. No other name appears on the title. So I think typically sometimes you can see that in automobiles or whatever else. You see just one person's name. Sometimes it's you and your spouse together. But there can be individual ownership. There can be tenants in common. This is an undivided interest in property that you own with another individual. Let me just give you an example. Let's say you own some kind of a piece of development property, 40 acres, with your brother. You and your brother have owned this for many years. If it's 40 acres, when it's a tenant in common relationship, what it means is you each own that 40 acres. Now, one of you doesn't own 20 and the other 20. You own the full 40 acres together. You're tenants in common. It's an undivided interest. Then there's also what they call joint tenants with rights of survivorship. That's the same. It's an undivided interest or property that you own, but it has a special provision that at the death of the one owner, the survivor will own the entire property. Let me jump back to the tenants in common. I could be owning a piece of property with my brother, but if I die, what happens with my interest depends on my will. If we are joint tenants with right of survivor, when I die, the property belongs to him by the titling of the property. It has nothing to do with the will. Then there's also tenants by the entirety. It's the same as joint tenants with right of survivorship, except it only applies to property owned by a husband and wife. For estate planning purposes, it's identical. However, property held as tenants by the entirety cannot be sold during the lifetime without the consent of the spouse. Again, just an important distinction. And then there's also community property, and there are a number of states if you own property, and they're in community property states, and they were acquired after the marriage, each spouse owns one half, no matter how the property is titled. Now, it's important, again, to understand this. You'll understand it more in a minute as we get into estate planning issues, because how things are titled is very, very, very important. And often we don't know how we own property, because it happened a long time ago. If I quizzed you right now and said, whose name's on the title of your car? You'd think you know. You'd say, I think we put it in both our names, but you probably haven't looked at the title since you bought the car. You filed it in the safe deposit box or in some file cabinet somewhere. You don't remember. You can't remember whose name it's titled in. That can happen frequently with an investment account. Yeah, we checked off a box. I think it was joint tenants with right of survivor, but I don't remember. So how you own it's very important, because obviously, as I just pointed out before, let's say I have that piece of property with my brother, 40 acres, you know, and in my will I wrote, when I die, I want that piece, my interest in that property to go to my spouse. And then I die, and suddenly, and we'll get to this in a minute, my brother owns the entire piece of land if I did it as tenant in common. I'm sorry, tenant with right of survivorship. If I did it with right of survivorship, because of the way I titled it, was entitled with my brother, despite what my will said, give it to my wife. But before they even opened up the will, it didn't matter. Because by what they call operation of law, it goes to my brother. So we need to make sure we understand how our property is titled. There are 6 basic types of property. There's household goods and personal effects. Generally, you don't know how you own these things. Who owns the couch? There's no title to the couch. I mean, it's just one of your personal effects. Often we have collections. I think of Carlos's all his cameras in his house. You know, there's no title to those cameras. There's no way of figuring out that those belong to Carlos, unless you've got them registered, Carlos, somehow. But otherwise, there's no proof of that. Often we own things with no title at all. There are savings accounts. We're basically referring to banking instruments, CDs, passbook savings accounts, money market accounts. That's another type of property. We have stocks, bonds, mutual funds, usually some type of investment account. These are held in. Sometimes we hold them in the actual certificates as well, especially if they've been in the family for a while. Real estate. This includes your personal residence, investment real estate, limited partnerships, farm property, or any business real estate that's not owned by a corporation. It's also important to know that if you own real estate in more than one state, if you own a piece of property, for example, in Pennsylvania or New York or a vacation home somewhere in another state, that's very important when it comes to estate planning. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, because you're going to likely have to probate in two different states if you own real estate somewhere else. So it may be reasons to be considering a trust. You also could have a business interest if you own a business. It'll become an important part of your estate plan. And then there's also life insurance. It's an interesting asset because, generally speaking, it has no value during your lifetime, but suddenly has a value at your death. And so usually that moves outside of what they call the probate process. And again, it's got its own beneficiaries listed, but we'll talk a little bit about that, how that coordinates with your estate plan. Questions so far on those two issues? You're going to understand the importance of these as we look at the estate plan and how the puzzle fits together, the pieces of the puzzle fit together. All right. As I mentioned earlier, we're going to take a break in just a minute here. I want to just cover a basic concept here before we do that, about property ownership and distribution of property at death. It's important that we learn about those things, because two things happen when you die. There will be property that will pass through your will at the time of death. And we talked about those ownership issues earlier, the individual ownership issues, tenants in common or community property. That will pass through your will. Property passing by joint owner at time of death, these will be joint tenants with right of survivorship or tenants by the entirety. So, again, sometimes the transfer happens by how things are titled, and sometimes it happens by what's in the will. And it's important to understand that distinction. So as you put your estate plan together, it accomplishes what you think it's going to accomplish. You know, sadly, all too frequently, someone thinks in their mind, here's the plan I had for distribution, and it doesn't work out that way. Now, God's called you home. You're not aware of it anymore, but you thought, your kids are going, wait a minute, Dad said something about, you know, blah, 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 and yet this happened. It's maybe because Dad didn't understand that he didn't title something the way he thought it was titled, and so things... Although, you know, for example, especially the case, I thought it was going to be divided evenly. And yet, maybe somehow in the life policy, you know, Dad put the beneficiaries on of two of the three kids, and because the third one wasn't born yet or something like that. So he only put two names instead of just saying divide it to the children equally, which he could have done. He gave it to Mary and to John, but he never gave it to David. You know, and so it was by an oversight, and he never went back to check the beneficiary form in the life policy, that suddenly there was a disparity in the distribution. And so you need to be familiar with how things are owned, who's the beneficiary, and how those are fit together so that your plan really carries out your wishes. Now, how do we transfer that property? We'll take a break and come back and figure out how to transfer property after that break.